Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I am John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, February 9, 2017. A top UN official advises the Kiir administration to include opposition in the country's dialogue.
I should remind President Kiir and his government so to acknowledge that peace is not made among friends. It is made among enemies, quote unquote. Although I would prefer to call these people not enemies because they are brothers and sisters.
And Germany is asking the Kiir administration to fight corruption.
The transparency in the financing and transparency in the spending is very important for us, as we already provide support of over $1 billion to South Sudan every year, especially in the humanitarian field, but also development aid and reconstruction.
We will have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. While the South Sudan government prepares for a national dialogue next month, one UN official says the exercise could be undermined by the ongoing violence in the country. The UN Special Advisor on Prevention of Genocide, Adama Dieng, says the Kiir administration should focus on creating meaningful dialogue that includes the opposition and other political parties in the country.
This is very alarming, the situation. I can tell you that fleeing, the violence en masse, and the restriction of the areas, you know, which is, to my view, something which we have to ensure that people will be able to return to peace.
You mentioned the need for dialogue in South Sudan, and President Kiir announced this week that the national dialogue will begin next month. But in a recent statement, you appear to have some reservations on the credibility of a national dialogue in South Sudan.
Unless that national dialogue is inclusive, I will keep my assessment. I will remain having that. Having said so, I'm glad that President Kiir acknowledged that the national dialogue is going to take place in early March, if I am not wrong. I'm glad that he has mentioned that that is the only way to bring peace in South Sudan. Having said so, I should remind President Kiir and his government so to acknowledge that peace is not made among friends. It is made among enemies, quote unquote. Although I would prefer to call these people not enemies because they are brothers and sisters. And only that will make such a national dialogue being a successful, leading to a successful peace process, which means in other place, ensure that it takes place definitely in March as announced, that it also offer credible political alternatives to the opposition, including Riek Machar and the other rebels and opposition who are now currently excluded. There is no other way.
And you're sure about that? There's no other way?
Well, I am sure that unless you have an inclusive process, I'm afraid you may defeat temporarily one group, you may defeat another group, but at the end of the day, unless you are inclusive, and from that inclusivity, you have a national dialogue which should definitely also aim towards really ensuring that management in South Sudan, management of diversity, is done in the most constructive manner. That people no longer feel that they are belonging to an ethnic A, B, C, or D, but they feel simply that they are South Sudanese.
Do you think that the United Nations should change its strategy in South Sudan, given the serious nature of the warnings that are coming out of your office?
Well, as you may know, we have briefed the Security Council in November, And there were recommendations which were made regarding imposing arms embargo on South Sudan, increasing targeted sanctions. Unfortunately, agreement was not reached on either proposal before the Security Council. But at the same time, we are seeing weapons continuing to flow into the country. And that is why I think today what is extremely important, and I'm glad that the Kenyan troops will also return to South Sudan. And I'm glad that IGAD is going also to work closely with the African Union, with the help of the United Nations, and that pressure will continue to be made on the South Sudanese leadership so that really we can come to an end.
Now, UNMISS has come under heavy criticism, particularly when it comes to the protection of civilians. There have been reports of UNMISS military patrols abandoning their post, and other reports say peacekeepers failed to engage to protect themselves and the civilians which they are mandated to protect. Are the criticisms against UNMISS fair?
Absolutely no. They are not fair. I mean, imagine having UN troops between two camps. If you shoot in one camp, the other will say you are taking sides. So ultimately, the only thing UNMISS could do, and that what he's doing today, is to protect the civilian. I have visited the POC where South Sudanese are under the protection of UNMISS. Now the rest is, it is, and I repeat myself, the responsibility of the South Sudanese to ensure that their population are protected.
That was Adama Dieng, the UN Special Advisor on the Prevention of Genocide. He was speaking to Ayen Bior yesterday from UN headquarters in New York. South Sudan's finance minister, Stephen Diu Dao, is asking the donor community to help fund a $200 million budget deficit for this fiscal year. German's ambassador to South Sudan, Johann Lefthand, says he welcomes the government's economic reform agenda, but says Juba must be transparent on how it spends its money. Tito Justin has more for VOA from Juba.
Last year, South Sudan's Transitional National Legislative Assembly passed a 22 billion South Sudanese pound budget for fiscal year 2016 to 2017, but Finance Minister Stephen Diu Dao says the government cannot raise the funds needed to implement the reform agenda in the peace deal. Dao briefed representatives of donor countries yesterday on the country's economic woes and described what the government intends to do to stabilize the economy. He says the Kiir's administration will establish a national revenue authority to build South Sudan's central bank capacity and control government expenditures.
We need from them the support. We appreciated their continued support in need of humanitarian assistance. Also, I requested them to support us in the budget support, the deficit, which is over $200 million US.
Dao insists the government has already begun implementing reforms stipulated in the peace agreement.
The reforms are only on the way, the institutional reforms, the reviewing of the legislation, existing legislations are underway, are being reviewed and implemented.
Speaking on behalf of the donor community, Germany's ambassador to South Sudan, Johannes Lerner, praised Dao for initiating some reforms, including forming a national revenue authority and changes in the state-owned petroleum corporation, Nile Petroleum. But he says the government must be transparent on how it spends international donor money to rebuild the country.
We think it's very important to continue this with all their possibilities and with all their power they have. The transparency in the financing and transparency in the spending is very important for us, as we already provide support of over $1 billion to South Sudan every year, especially in the humanitarian field, but also development aid and reconstruction after areas of South Sudan have been destroyed by war.
Ambassador Lene says Germany will continue to work with the South Sudan government to implement the country's reform agenda.
We are already with a lot of money in the support for South Sudan. The German support to South Sudan is over $100 million every year in different areas.
And Lene says Germany will continue to cooperate with the South Sudan's Minister of Finance to help stabilize the country's economy. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
From Juba, we move to Khartoum, where Sudanese and South Sudanese lawmakers say they are working to strengthen peace and stability in both countries and open up channels of cooperation in legislative affairs. Sudanese officials wrapped up a three-day visit to Juba yesterday. As Nabil Biagio reports for VOA from Juba, lawmakers from both countries say the visit helped build trust between the two nations' political leaders.
Omar Suleiman Adam, president of Sudan's Council of States, led the Sudanese delegation to Juba following an invitation from Joseph Bol Chan, the speaker of South Sudan's Council of States. Speaking in Arabic, Adam says, they met with First Vice President Taban Dengai and other top South Sudanese government officials to try to resolve long-standing issues.
We have had several agreements signed between our two countries, and we hope that they will make a breakthrough that will cement peace and stability in both countries. But there have been unresolved issues that the two countries approach from different perspectives. There have been also mutual accusations of supporting each other's enemies. This is also not resolved yet.
But Adam says agreements were reached on trade and security arrangements. He says border issues were also discussed, but not completely resolved.
We have been talking about whether to demarcate the border first or just go ahead and open official channels for trade between Sudan and South Sudan. We have had disagreements, but we are still in open dialogue and are trying to build more trust between us. And I believe we are making progress.
Adam says security remains the top priority between the neighboring countries.
The bottom line is that security in either country is important to the other. Then how to overcome our differences and work for the betterment of both our countries by achieving peace and stability. I think we are making progress and will soon achieve a breakthrough.
Speaking in Arabic, Chan confirms that security was the most important topic under discussion between the South Sudanese and Sudanese officials, including the need to expel all rebels operating in each other's countries.
I think the lack of implementation of these agreements is directly related to a lack of trust between the two governments. But I think with what we are doing here, we are moving in the right direction, especially when we meet with First Vice President Mr. Taban Deng. We were all assured of the ongoing cooperation in security arrangements between Sudan and South Sudan. We will soon hear good things in that regard.
Chan says South Sudan will make good on its promise to expel Sudanese rebels from its soil and expect Sudan to do the same.
Sudan has a close eye on South Sudan, and we in South Sudan have a close eye on Sudan. I cannot reveal much about that, but I assure you that the doubts and the mistrust that used to taint our bilateral relations will be replaced with honest engagement.
The Sudanese delegation also affirmed President Omar al-Bashir's commitment to allow the World Food Program to continue delivering food assistance from Sudan to South Sudan based on the tripartite agreement signed in July 2014. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, Kenya's High Court blocks the government from shutting down one of the largest refugee camps in the world. That story is coming up next.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today.
How do you handle a friend who dismisses your opinions?
Most of the time, I just leave them because I would rather not argue with a person. I would rather just leave them and stick to their ideas and I'll stick to mine.
If I know the opinions I'm giving out to my friend, they are productive and they are of help, I persist till when I see that they pick out value out of the opinions I'm giving them.
Definitely, if I'm giving you my opinion, I care. So if you dismiss my opinion, I just notice I just don't need to care for you like I am trying to.
I just obey his opinion. I believe that when he has a right to dismiss my opinion, and I do respect whatever he comes up with.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. Kenya's High Court has blocked the government from closing the Dadaab refugee camp, home to nearly 260,000 Somali refugees. Human rights groups filed the case after the government voted to close the camp last May. VOA's Jill Craig has the story from Nairobi.
The largest refugee camp in the world will remain open, according to Kenyan High Court Justice John Mativo, who ruled Thursday that the government's orders to close the camp were discriminatory and indignifying.
That the government's decision, specifically targeting Somali refugees, is an act of group persecution, illegal, discriminatory, and therefore unconstitutional.
Mativo also stated that the disbanded Department of Refugee Affairs should be reinstated. In May 2016, the government announced it would be closing Dadaab, a massive refugee camp sheltering about 258,000 Somali refugees, by November. That move was then delayed for an additional 6 months. 24-year-old Mohamed Abdullahi Jamale is one of those who would have been affected by the camp's closure.
Really, that is the best ever news I've ever had, because somebody like me who was born and raised in the camps, who has never seen Somalia and who don't know anything about Somalia, is really welcoming this, and we really appreciate the rulings of the court.
But not everyone is pleased with the verdict. Kenya Ministry of the Interior spokesperson Mwenda Njoka says the government plans to appeal the ruling because its original motivation for closing the camp remains.
The main reason was security. The fact that the camps had started, they had lost their humanitarian character, and they became places where terrorists would come, Al-Shabaab, their sympathizers would go and plan the attacks on Kenya. So that has not changed. And the fact also that right now the Republic of Somalia has also stabilized significantly. They just elected a new president yesterday.
Deputy Regional Director for Amnesty International, Michelle Kagari, is pleased with the ruling, but acknowledges that Kenya has borne a disproportionate burden when it comes to hosting refugees.
And this is an opportunity really for Kenya to demonstrate leadership to ensure durable solutions to the refugee population, including pushing for rich governments, Western governments, to step up to the plate and take up their responsibility and share the burden with regards to hosting refugees.
According to UNHCR Kenya spokesperson Yvonne Ndege, Kenya has always been a hospitable country where people could seek protection and assistance.
And so this perhaps is a sign or a reinforcement of the kind of culture and attitude that Kenyans have towards their neighboring countries and the people of those countries who, for one reason or another, have had to flee here.
But regardless of the results of the appeal, Njoka says the Kenyan government will comply.
We operate within the confines of the law. So if we were to lose, we would definitely have to work with that. I mean, we can't defy a court order.
In addition to Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, the Norwegian Refugee Council, and Doctors Without Borders also released statements expressing their approval of the court's decision. Since mid-May 2016, when the Kenyan government announced its closure decision, almost 34,000 refugees have gone to Somalia through the UN Refugee Agency's Return Assistance Program. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Somalia has a new president. Yesterday, the parliament elected Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed on the second round of voting. He beat the incumbent 184 votes to 97. Nevertheless, the way ahead looks anything but easy. Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed took the oath of office Wednesday, soon after his victory was announced.
In a short speech, the new president said, "This victory belongs to the people of Somalia. This victory is a start of building a united, peaceful and stable Somalia. This is the beginning of democracy and fighting corruption." Outgoing President Hassan Sheikh Mohamud won praise for how he conceded defeat Wednesday and wished his successor well. But the country is far from its aim of holding nationwide one-man, one-vote elections. Security is the main challenge. Parliament members had to be elected last year by clan leaders and regional representatives. Allegations of widespread vote-buying overshadowed the electoral process, including the presidential race. President Mohamed, or Farmajo as he's more commonly known, is well remembered for his time as Prime Minister under the transitional government. He served less than a year between 2010 and 2011, but is credited with paying the salaries of the country's security forces and government workers on time, including Parliament. International Crisis Group Horn of Africa analyst Rashid Abdi is optimistic about the choice.
There are feelings that if there is anyone who can do something about security, then it must be him, because, again, of his very good relationship with the security services. And we saw how, immediately the news came through that he had won, how the security forces themselves joined, local people to demonstrate, to welcome, that victory. And that support, I think, is probably also quite critical for him to succeed in stabilizing Somalia.
Somalia media reports government soldiers have not been paid for the past 6 months, something many hope will change and give the troops the morale needed to defeat al-Shabaab. The al-Qaeda terror group still carries out regular attacks and bombings in many parts of the country, including Mogadishu. The new president favours building up the national army so that it will be ready when the mandate of the African Union force in Somalia comes to an end next year. Abdi says analysts fear a push to assert Somalia's autonomy may create tensions, with the countries contributing to the regional force, in particular Ethiopia and Kenya.
If I were to advise him, I would tell him to proceed to go slow in relationship with these two neighbouring countries, and I think to build new bridges, and because I think they ultimately have a collective interest, joint interest, strategic interest in working together to stabilise Somalia.
Analysts point out Farmajo got votes in parliament from clans around the country. He's seen as a nationalist and a unifier, despite having spent much of his adult life in the United States, where he's also a citizen. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
South Africa's embattled President Jacob Zuma makes his annual State of the Nation speech today amid a struggling economy and low approval ratings. In recent years, his speeches have been marked by protests from the opposition members. Most recently, Zuma has been battered by financial and corruption scandals. Reporter Dahlia Robertson has been following Zuma's troubled presidency and spoke to VOA's Jody Kapwa from Johannesburg.
Basically, all the scandals that have surrounded him and in which he seems to have been a central player have finally caught up with him. In the past several months, he's had direct challenges to his authority within the ruling African National Congress. At a meeting of the executive of the party, a proposal was put to the meeting that he be dismissed from his post. That didn't pass. But then shortly after that, Chief Whip of the party in Parliament called on him to step down. This has been a severe disruption to his power base.
Would you first summarize the financial scandal and then the corruption scandal that he is now facing?
Well, the financial scandal came about when he fired the former finance minister, Mr. Nene, and put in his position a person who had no background or experience, who was very unknown. This all happened in December 2015. There was such a backlash to the extent that a few days later, he was forced to fire Des van Rooyen and reinstate Pravin Gordhan, who has been finance minister in the past and a very efficient and successful one.
So why would he dismiss him?
The feeling is that he wanted somebody in that position that he could order around. The target of Mr. Zuma and his family and his cronies, such as the Gupta family, are believed to have been the actual treasury, to find ways of diverting funds, state funds, to strange business interests through state-owned companies, to individuals, and that sort of thing.
Now, this financial scandal is on top of the scandal surrounding the millions of dollars he has to repay for renovations at one of his homes.
Well, it was more than renovation. It was the building of a huge estate with several homes to accommodate his various wives, an amphitheater, a swimming pool, which they euphemistically called a fire pool, saying it was needed to fight potential fires. The total bill was around $14 million. Subsequently, he was ordered by the Constitutional Court to pay back at least some of the money. I believe it was about $3 million.
Now, there were also corruption allegations against the president. I believe these involve the influential Gupta family.
Yes, this family is a family that came to South Africa from India and gradually gained more influence with people in power, including Mr. Zuma. And this was shown 3 years ago when they flew their private aircraft into a South African Air Force base near Pretoria to bring all their guests for a family wedding. Mr. Zuma's son is very closely linked to this family. Mr. Zuma is closely linked to this family. They have gotten contracts for all kinds of government jobs. They have been awarded mining licenses. Many, many enterprises are involved here.
That's reporter Delia Robertson speaking to VOA's Joe DiCapua from Johannesburg. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here is a recap of today's top stories with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Dam.
Thanks, John. While the South Sudan government prepares for a national dialogue in March, a UN official says the talks could be undermined by the controversy of the violence that continues in the country. Adama Deng, the UN special advisor to the Secretary General on the Prevention of Genocide, says the Kiir administration should focus on creating meaningful dialogue that includes the opposition and a clear path to justice. Deng says the situation in South Sudan is very alarming, including the continued fleeing of citizens to neighboring countries. He also says the dialogue must include the opposition beyond Vice President Taban Dengai, whom President Kiir appointed. South Sudan Finance Minister Stephen Du Dao is calling on international donors to give the government $200 million to fill a gap in its current fiscal year budget, which Du says will cover economic reforms in the 2015 peace agreement. Germany's ambassador to South Sudan, Johannes Lange, says while he welcomes the government's economic reform agenda, the government must also be transparent in how it spends its money. And finally, Sudanese and South Sudanese lawmakers say they're trying to strengthen peace and stability in both countries by increasing cooperation efforts between the diplomats. That's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Dam.
That's our show for this Thursday. We now leave you with the song African Style by Kawaja Revolution.
Kawaja Revolution, yo. The mighty sun bandit dancer, African team song, yo.
Don't
We have been listening to Kawaja Revolution with that song, African Style. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. We invite you to join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.